Hello, Health Investor. Welcome to another episode of the Health Investment Podcast. Today, you're going to hear from Michael Moss. Michael is a journalist and the author of two New York Times best-selling books on the processed food industry, Salt, Sugar, Fat, and Hooked. He's a frequent guest on newscasts globally, from CBS This Morning to the BBC. His keynote speeches to corporations and organizations feature his work as an investigative reporter with the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. In the episode, Michael shares how the food industry uses the perfect mix of salt, sugar, and fat to hijack our taste buds, why the grocery store is not a level playing field, practical steps anyone can take to reduce their processed food consumption, and more. If you're liking this podcast, I'd be so grateful if you'd write a review and share it with a friend. Enjoy the episode.
I'm Brooke Simonson, certified nutrition coach and your host of the Health Investment Podcast. If you're ready to look and feel your best without any confusion, frustration, or stress, you're in the right place. Each week, I interview experts and share no-nonsense, research-backed tips so that you can finally lose weight for good, eat healthy long-term, have the high energy you crave, and feel like a million bucks. I'm so happy you're here with me today. Don't forget to hit subscribe so that you never miss an episode.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for joining me today on the Health Investment Podcast.
Really great to be with you.
Really excited to connect with a New Yorker. I've actually connected with quite a few New Yorkers recently. So I was telling you I used to live there. We moved out here to California for family, but my husband and I plan on moving back. So I almost feel like it's a sign. I just keep talking to New Yorkers. It's like it's pulling me back.
Yeah, and I'm a California boy, born and raised. So we've just crossed over the middle of the country.
Absolutely. I know. And I guess two great places to live if you have to choose. I will say the weather is something tough to beat in California.
Yeah, although today it's gorgeous here in Brooklyn. So we have our moments.
You do. And I think it's fun when it's been rainy or cold and then you get those beautiful days. I think you just kind of appreciate them more in New York versus in California. It's beautiful every day, kind of. Yeah. So you get really used to it. And absolutely. Then if it's rainy, you freak out because it's like, what's going on? We're supposed to have perfect weather. Yeah. Can you start a bit and tell us about your background, specifically what led you to write your books, Salt, Sugar, Fat, and Hooked?
Yeah, so I've been a news reporter for most of my life, working for little papers and big papers. Back in 2008, I was in Algeria, of all places, writing about Islamic militancy, of all things, when I got in some trouble and had to come home. And my editor in New York at the New York Times had spotted this outbreak of salmonella in peanuts being manufactured down on the Georgia-Alabama border. And I went down and these peanuts were sickening thousands of people around the country being used as ingredients by some of the largest processed food companies. And that story that I went and reported on for the Times, and then subsequently I reported on a contamination in meat by the meat industry, just sort of opened this world of big food to me that I felt we hadn't been paying enough attention to. And I was continuing to write about contaminants, accidental contamination of food. One of my best sources who tests meat for E. coli said to me, you know, Michael, as tragic as these incidents are, you really should look at some of the things my industry intentionally adds to its products. And he was concerned about all the salt in processed meat, but that got me to look at sugar and fats as well as these powerful ingredients that the industry uses to get us to not just like their products, but to love them. And so that's how the two books came to be.
Wow. Can you talk a bit about processed food and like why it's very important that they have this perfect formula of salt, sugar, fat, and what that does to our taste buds and how that's even linked to part of the obesity epidemic?
Yeah, I mean, it's really pretty simple from their standpoint, right? I mean, their job in their view is to maximize sales. And you do that by maximizing the allure of the product. And they discovered that we go crazy for things like salt, sugar, fat, in part because we're biologically designed to respond to them. And so they pay very sort of close attention to the amounts and types of those three ingredients that they use in their products. And they have beautiful language, you know, to talk about kind of their effort to maximize the allure of their products. And by the way, you know, they hate the word addiction more than anything, but they talk about things like maximizing the snackability of their products or the craveability or the moorishness. And so salt is really important to them. They call it the flavor burst because salt is typically the first thing to touch the tongue. It's typically on the outside of a snack. And in doing so, the saliva interacts with it, and that will send a signal almost immediately to the what's called the reward center of the brain that says to you, wow, I love what you're doing. Let's do more of that. Sugar they call the bliss point, right? Because of this idea that if they get the most perfect amount of sugar in a product, not too little, not too much, it will send us over the moon and their products flying off the shelves. And fat they refer to as the mouthfeel. It's not a true taste. It's more of a sensation picked up by the trigeminal nerve, which comes down to from the roof of your mouth, your tongue. And it's that sensation of biting into a toasted cheese sandwich. And you can probably tell I'm more of a fat salt guy because my brain is lighting up just thinking about that toasted cheese sandwich and the mouthfeel that provides. And while those three ingredients are incredibly terrific in the hands of a home cook, what's different about the processed food industry is that they've kind of marched around the grocery store, adding things, especially sugar, to products that never used to be sweet before. So they've built into us now this expectancy that everything should be salty, sweet, fatty, so that when we drag ourselves over to the produce aisle, right, where every nutritionist says we should be spending more time, you know, your brain is rebelling, going, hey, where's the sweet and the fat and the salty stuff? And I should mention, too, that one of the most powerful thing about these three ingredients is the combination. So scientists at Yale, now at McGill up in Canada, discovered that there's this part of the brain called the striatum where arguably habits are formed. And the striatum responds particularly strongly to foods that are both sugary and fatty. And when you think about it, there aren't many foods in nature that are both sugary and fat. It's sort of this cunning ability of the design of the products that these companies have been making, especially since 1980, that contain both sugar and fat. And that combination gets the brain super excited and compels us to eat when the rational part of us is saying, hey, I think we had enough.
Mm. You mentioned the word addiction. How does your understanding of addiction in terms of food differ from maybe traditional foods or traditional views or in terms of alcoholism or something? I mean, how is addiction to food similar or different from some of these more common addictions?
Yeah, I mean, I used to. And so salt, sugar, fat came out and one of the very first questions, and I tried to sort of shy away from the use of the word addiction because it just seemed sort of too caustic and too kind of severe for food. I mean, the idea of comparing Twinkies to heroin seemed ludicrous to me. But the very first question I got from a reporter was, well, look, Michael, aren't you really talking about products here that are, in fact, as addictive as some drugs even? And so how can you say at the end of the book that knowledge is power and we can kind of decide what to eat and how much? And I really felt they had a point. And so I took a long, hard work at this question of whether we should be thinking about some of these processed food products as being addictive. And I came full circle on that question. I actually think that in some ways, food is even more addictive, even more trouble for us than tobacco, alcohol, even even some drugs. One of the ways that food is more powerful is that it creates memories in our heads starting from when we're kids, right? This is the reason why soda companies spend so much time and effort trying to market to kids in ball stadiums, knowing that when they're, you know, at a game with their parents having the time of their lives, if they can get a soda into that kid's hand, that soda and that moment of joy will forevermore be associated with kid's head for the rest of their life. And I had that experience recently, well, not recently, it was a few years ago, when I went to the Kellogg's factory in Battle Creek, Michigan, you know, talking about something else entirely, but we were in the R&D facility and this aroma of Pop-Tarts came wafting across the factory floor. And I hadn't had a Pop-Tart since I was a latchkey kid in San Francisco, actually coming home from school. And having a strawberry Pop-Tart, but I hadn't known it since then, but that aroma triggered the memory of the Pop-Tart, which had never left my head, and it was like, wow, I could taste it, and I was right back to being a kid and being overjoyed by that taste and that smell of the Pop-Tart. So that's one way that food is so powerful, is that it creates memories, and it associates food memories with other emotions in us that last for an entire lifetime.
I had one client, I work with clients on nutrition and weight loss. And one client said to me, I was really successful at giving up smoking and alcohol, and food still has this grip over me. And she was describing, you can survive without smoking or drinking alcohol, but you need to eat to survive. Oh, totally. And so how pervasive it is that you have to eat. I mean, let's say maybe not three times a day, but you're probably eating, let's say three, four, maybe even five times a day. And then when you go into these grocery stores that are filled with these processed products that are the perfect combination of salt, sugar, fat, that are meant to hook you and become addictive in a way. I mean, that's a great challenge. It's not just, oh, you know, and now I'll just give up food and keep all food out of my house.
Yeah, I mean, probably the first thing you learn as an alcoholic in recovery is don't go anywhere near the liquor store, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, it's very simple, but you can't do that with food. And walking into a grocery store for somebody who is triggered by Oreos and Doritos and Hot Pockets is like an alcoholic walking into a liquor store. It's beyond most people's ability to sort of control that situation. And yes, that is another way that food is more trouble for us, is that we just can't go cold turkey and stop eating. We have to eat, and food is with us for the rest of our life, like it or not. And so dealing with that is really problematic.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people also on social media will say something like, I'm addicted to sugar. But then I've seen other people, other nutrition scientists, kind of counter that and say, you're not really addicted to sugar. You're not just eating tablespoons of sugar, of white granulated sugar. It's really the combinations that it comes down to. As you described, most of the sugary things we're eating are a combination of the sugar and fat, or maybe even there's some salt added. And so there are these perfect formulas that have been created in labs over what I assume to be months, if not years, to be, you know, fine-tuned to be the absolute best thing you've ever tasted.
Yeah. And it's not just salt, sugar, and fat. I mean, so these products are designed with sound in mind, because the companies know, for instance, that the more noise a potato chip makes, the more apt we are to eat more of those potato chips. We get excited by that noise. They're also designed with speed in mind. And I think that's one of the most powerful tools that the processed food industry has. It's having turned so much of the grocery store into fast food. And the parallel there to addiction and other troublesome product substances is that the faster that a product hits our brain, the more apt we are to lose control of our ability to say no. And that's why, you know, that's why drug users turn from snorting cocaine to smoking cocaine and crack, because it provided a harsher, faster, harder, quicker high. And so much about the processed food industry is about speed of the manufacturing process to make the products cheaper and cheaper, the packaging to make it easier and easier to get your paws in and a whole handful of stuff out. And then the speed with which those products hit the reward center of your brain, being, you know, highly processed, highly refined, so that, yes, those signals attack the brain in a way that's even faster than smoke and alcohol can be.
I want to take a quick break from the episode to tell you about a company I've been impressed by for years. Thrive Market is an online shopping platform that offers thousands of products at 25 to 50% off retail prices. For just $60 a year, you get access to a wide variety of premium pantry staples, supplements, beauty products, and home goods at unbeatable prices. To put things in perspective, I save about $20 to $30 per shipment, which means my annual membership fee pays for itself after just two orders. My favorite part about Thrive Market is that for every paid membership, they donate a membership to a low-income family, veteran, or teacher. So not only do you save money on your purchases, but you also make healthy products accessible to everyone. To read my full Thrive Market review, steal my shopping list of over 150 items, and save additional money on your first order, visit thehealthinvestment.com/Thrive Market or just click through the link in the show notes. Now, back to the episode.
It's pretty crazy to think about that every day we're alive, food becomes faster and more accessible than the previous day in one way. You know, like 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it wasn't as fast and maybe addictive as now. And in 10, 20 years from now, it'll become even more so. And then add to that, we have apps now where we can get things delivered within 20 minutes from DoorDash or Uber Eats. I mean, it's pretty incredible to think about.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the things I look for in the grocery store when I'm thinking about sort of what trouble a product might present to me. And it's the convenience. And it's basically the more convenient a product is, meaning the faster we can throw it into our shopping cart and bring it home and open it up and eat it and consume it, the bigger kind of the hidden cost will be. And that's how I like to define a lot of, and people are really struggling these days to define, like, what is this stuff that causes us the most trouble in the grocery store? Is it the highest fat or salt or sugar? Should we call it ultra processed food? But really, I think the speed and the convenience are really telling features. And if you're looking to kind of change how you value food and regain control of your eating habits, I think that's one way that could be helpful to sort of frame it, which is, how convenient is this food and what am I paying for that convenience?
Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, you know, our grandparents, if they wanted a chocolate chip cookie, they would have to bake a batch of cookies versus we can buy Chips Ahoy and eat the whole sleeve in minutes, no baking required. So one of my clients, we had a big conversation about this and she loved ginger snap cookies. And so I said, you know, what if you were to just make them and maybe make a big batch of dough and even freeze the dough? And then when you wanted one, you had to actually bake it. And it worked great for her. It's not that she has to cut out ginger snap cookies, but just having a little more thought and intention required in making something versus now we're all working from home as well. And everything's at arm's length all the time, right in the kitchen. I mean, that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I mean, my mom used to tell us to chew our food 20 times before swallowing. And it wasn't just to avoid, you know, choking on the roast beef or whatever. I think she instinctually knew. And I think science has sort of showed that it takes time for, like, signals in your stomach to sort of alert the brain to your having eaten enough, right? The feeling of fullness, of satiety. But the other beautiful thing about cooking, it does seem to be an antidote to speed and to that convenience. It slows you down. It prepares your brain and the body for receiving the food, because one of the hallmarks, again, of processed food is that they've managed to make these incredibly energy-dense products where you're getting half a day's calories in a couple of bites. And there's like no way that your body is going to alert you to that until it's way too late and you've eaten a couple of days worth of calories. And so there's also kind of this mismatch going on between our biology and these processed food companies that scientists have sort of, you know, like to frame it, which is our ability to sort of control these products just hasn't had time biologically to catch up. Because really, we're talking about the last 50 years in these companies having dramatically changed the nature of our food in a way that, you know, our genes and our biology hasn't had time to catch up on.
Right. I have a lot of clients say something to me like, I just can't stop eating potato chips. And they think of it as a moral failure. But the way you're describing this, you're kind of reframing it as there's not something broken inside of you. It's they're literally meant to be these items that hijack your senses and kind of take away all inhibitions. And so I say for myself, it's hard to stop eating potato chips if I'm eating straight out of the bag. So I have to put different systems in place where I get a small bowl, I put some in there, I put the bag away, I finish them. I want more. I always want more. But I sit kind of with the disappointment of, oh, the bowl's gone. That kind of stinks. You know, I wish I had more, but I'm not going to get more. It's this whole kind of process to kind of moderate intake versus, you know, I'm not, there's not something special about me where I just get a bag and all of a sudden feel satisfied after five.
And you know, the officials in these companies actually sort of know that. And that's one reason why they don't eat their own products. They know better. And not only that, but one of the surprising things to me was that, you know, I don't know if you knew this, but, you know, back in the early 1980s, Philip Morris, the big tobacco company, bought this old food company called General Foods, a maker of Kool-Aid and a whole bunch of like big name brands in the grocery store. And then they bought Kraft, and then they bought Nabisco. And for years, the largest tobacco company in North America, Philip Morris, was also the single largest manufacturer of processed foods. And, you know, and you can see through their relationship that in the early years, the tobacco managers were, you know, doing this incredible thing for the food people, which basically they had a ton of cash and they were empowering the food people to kind of run with big, new, powerful products like the Lunchables. You know, the inventor of the Lunchables, right? You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
You know, flew to New York at an early stage of the development of that product and kind of sheepishly went to the tobacco, you know, managers at Philip Morris asking for like a little bit of money for marketing development. And they looked at him and said, are you crazy? You have done the most difficult part here, which you've invented this product that people are going to go nuts for. Here's a blank check, you know, knock yourself out. We'll give you all the money we want. But then something really interesting happened, which is when tobacco came under pressure from government attorneys looking to recover the billions of dollars that states were having to spend on health care for people getting sick from smoking, they became nervous that the food side of their company was going to be hit by litigation. And so they privately warned their food guys, and they said to them, you guys are going to face as much trouble over salt, sugar, fat, obesity, type 2 diabetes, as we are over smoking and cancer. You've got to do something to lessen your reliance, you know, on those ingredients and on that methodology. That was way back in the year 2000. But something else sort of happened personally, which is that tobacco guys, they like personally got scared of some of these products. I sat down with the former general counsel, top lawyer at Philip Morris, great guy named Steve Parrish. I mean, Philip Morris is known as the merchants of death, right? Mm-hmm. But he said to me, you know, Michael, I was one of those lucky people who could smoke one cigarette a day, put the pack away, not have any compulsion to pull it out again. But I couldn't go near a bag of our Oreo cookies, because they owned Oreos at the time, for fear of losing control and eating half the bag in one sitting. So it's really telling to know that even the people who owned and or designed and market and sell these products don't go near them, appreciating the engineering that goes in these products that just destroys our free will, our ability to say no.
In a former interview, you said the concepts of choice and free will may be something of an illusion when it comes to shopping for food. The grocery store is hardly a level playing field. Can you talk more about grocery stores and how those are set up?
Right. So we go to the store with a shopping list, right? And everything about the store is designed to sort of get us off that shopping list and buy what they call impulse things, right? Because they get a lot of money for that stuff. So, you know, you walk in the door and there's this like la-la music sort of playing to get you to like not think about those last 5 pounds you gained and not think about sort of yourself, right? They steer you towards certain sections of the store that have the most troublesome, seductive products. But even more is you're kind of lost even before you walk in the store because of those food memories that we talked about. Food memory is so important for them because that's where they target their marketing. So you're walking into the store with a head filled with advertising from the food industry for the products in the store, which are seducing you and drawing you to those products, despite that, you know, your best intentions with that shopping list. So that's why it's such an unlevel floor when we go shopping. They hold all the power, and even individual products, right? I mean, you know the thing called the nutrition facts box, right? Mm-hmm. So that's that little fine print on the back of a package that tells us how much salt and calcium is. And it's kind of crazy in my estimation, because I've been writing about this stuff for a long time and I can't really understand or kind of put that fact box into the context of what I've been eating all day or all year. But anyway, that aside, the most valuable real estate on a product is the front of the package. And that's totally owned and controlled by the food companies. And they're doing everything they can on the front of the package to get you not to think about the nutrition facts that are in it. So things like new and better or less sugar or more calcium are all part of the tools that they have to get us to do their bidding on what to buy and what to eat.
In terms of practical cutting back on processed foods, do you think online grocery shopping is a good strategy? Because you just have your list on there and you kind of go back to it and you're not tempted by everything you see. Is that something you think could kind of combat this?
Yeah, especially if sort of the online, you know, distributors have some sort of ethical code as well that's pushing better for you eating habits, right? I mean, I love the concept of nudge marketing, where through, you know, a discount or a little financial incentive, we're encouraged to make a better shopping purchase decision. So yeah, it could be, although a few years ago, and this was sort of coming up, they were doing the opposite. And they would, you know, they would go like, okay, you've just put $9.98 in your basket, you know, for just 2 more cents, you can get the 6-pack of Coca-Cola, right? So that kind of, so they can be just as bad as the grocery stores, but yeah, maybe in terms of reducing some of that impulse temptation, that might be one solution.
Outside of hosting this podcast, I work as a nutrition coach specializing in evidence-based sustainable weight loss. If you're ready to stop yo-yo dieting and start living a healthy, active lifestyle you're proud of, I'd love to work with you in one of my programs.
unlike restrictive, one-size-fits-all diets that only provide short-term results, I help you adopt science-backed nutrition and lifestyle habits that work for your unique likes, dislikes, and time constraints so you can lose weight permanently, have high energy throughout the day, feel completely in control of cravings, and stay consistent long-term. To learn more, visit thehealthinvestment.com or follow me on Instagram and TikTok at The Health Investment. Are there any other solutions that are in the works or that have already occurred or things that you're excited about?
Well, one of the great things about comparing food to other addictive substances is that there are lessons to be drawn. And so, you know, if you're somebody who can't control your eating of Oreo cookies, you're probably better off avoiding those altogether, or in drug parlance, abstaining, right, from that product. Keep those things out of the house, right? If you're somebody whose vulnerability, because again, sort of addiction happens on a spectrum, right? Products affect different people at different times of the day, different times of their lives, differently. So if you're a person who kind of gets nailed by the 3 p.m. craving for cookies, right? One of the lessons from the world of other addictive substances is that cravings happen so fast and so hard in the brain that the thinking part of the brain, the stop part of the brain, if you will, doesn't have time to catch up and slow you down. And so if that's your issue, one of the lessons from the world of drugs is that you need to prepare and have a plan in place and activate that plan, say at 2:45, to ward off that 3 p.m. craving. Whether your plan is, you know, walking around the block or calling a friend or eating something else like a handful of nuts. And then there's kind of the rest of us down further at the spectrum where kind of the trouble with processed food is just we're missing like the love and the beauty of sitting down with family and friends for a home cooked meal. And that's where kind of cooking comes into it. And the extent to which we can, you know, regain our ability to cook foods, and it doesn't have to be time consuming. And I've got a recipe for spaghetti sauce that's literally 90 seconds of work. And yet it's less expensive. I put a pinch of sugar because my mom always did, but I can control those ingredients. And because it's cooking, it's slowing me down and engaging me. And if I get the kids involved, all the better. So those are kind of the things that people could do individually, I think, to regain control of their eating habits and in the larger goal of revaluing what they think about and appreciate in food.
What do you make of all these companies who are now creating healthified versions of different things? So like a bread that has more protein and fiber, or the same thing with a cracker, or high protein Pop-Tarts even. There's a company that's doing high protein dessert type things that we ate in our childhood. Do you feel like those are on the rise and those are helpful, or are these companies doing the same thing that historically companies have done?
No, I think it's mostly marketing scam. It reminds me of when in the environment 10, 15 years ago was huge, and there was all this greenwashing going on where companies would pretend to make a better for the environment product. But in fact, when people drill down, it like was hardly better and even worse. And you're seeing that lots with the food companies now, which is making it again harder to walk into the grocery store and tell. And so yes, you've seen companies that are adding protein to sugary products, and yikes, you know, how is that really going to help in the long term? Trying to put their best foot forward. So it's getting harder and more tricky for us to really tell what's good and what's trouble for us in the store.
Absolutely. Yeah. Have you just been completely ruined by in grocery shopping through all your work? Is it just, do you just go in there and you can't turn it off?
No. I mean, I go in and I start laughing because, you know, having spent time with these companies and these scientists and marketing geniuses, I know what went on in creating all these products. And it's those stories that I kind of remember and laugh about when I'm when I'm shopping.
I'm sure even talking about the front of the packaging, there's always new buzzwords circulating. So I find it funny that all of a sudden then everything says avocado oil on it. Or, you know, there was the phase when everything said gluten-free on it because they're hearing, oh, people are now worried about gluten. Let's smack that on the front of this package. And so then somebody sees gluten-free and made with avocado oil and you think, oh, this is the healthy version of the chip.
Yeah, the former president of Coca-Cola who came to hate Coca-Cola and to try to make amends for his life work said to me at one point, you know, Michael, there really isn't any like smoking gun hidden in this industry. Everything is on the front of the package. You just have to read that fine print to know what's going on in these things. And all of their marketing strategy is right there. And you can just kind of see what their latest sense of the zeitgeist is. And they're going to be going after that with their advertising and the marketing and the packaging and the ingredients too, to some extent.
I've heard, you know, shop around the perimeter of the grocery store is a good strategy, kind of try to avoid those aisles in the middle. But even then, I feel like some of those products are even seeping into the perimeter. I mean, nowhere is safe.
Oh my gosh. I mean, just the other day, the FDA allowed yogurt companies to say on their label, the front, that yogurt may be beneficial in thwarting type 2 diabetes, without consideration for the massive amounts of sugar that many of the brands put in their yogurt. I was astounded when that came out, but that's kind of just the FDA being the FDA. And it kind of raises this other kind of important point, which is, I think it plays into the hands of the food giants when we think about food too much in terms of its nutritional components, the amount of salt, sugar, fat, you know, et cetera, protein, et cetera, in the products, and think less about just like real food and does this have stuff that real food has in it. And so I sort of shy away from trying to think about food in those kind of nutritionalism frameworks that the industry really loves.
Right. And that's on social media too. Everybody reducing down, you need this one ingredient or there's one superfood.
Yeah.
But really a food is a component of macronutrients, micronutrients. I mean, it's so much more than it's one ingredient. And then if somebody's saying you have to eat kale to be healthy and somebody hates kale, then they're feeling like they're doomed from the start. I mean, it's just, it's all convoluted.
We're really vulnerable to sort of the magic bullet sort of answer to things, sort of simple, two simple solutions to kind of complex issues. And one of the, in the last book, Hooked, I spent a chapter writing about the diet industry because I had no idea. But for many years, some of the biggest processed food companies owned some of the most popular diet plans and programs out there, including Weight Watchers.
Yeah. Right?
Which was just like, sadly ironic, hypocritical, whatever the right word is. I mean, on one hand, they're getting us to overconsume, and then the other hand, they're selling us on these very problematic schemes to help us then kind of lose that excess weight. But so much of the diet scheme, they're based on things like lose 30 pounds in 7 days, which is impossible in the long run, and yet we keep falling for it.
I know, and all of those programs, like you said, are reliant on some type of processed food replacement. And so then you buy the food, you eat it for the 7, 14, 30 days, you lose a lot of weight, but then what? I mean, are you going to eat that food forever? No, you're going to go back to your typical habits and your typical food, and you're going to gain all the weight back, and then you're going to do a new one. I mean, it's just this, it's a vicious cycle.
And they really count on us as living in a world where we're stressed and distracted and unable to pay attention to their tricks and schemes all day and all night. Mm. And they're just waiting for us to lower our guard, which happens, to sort of swoop in and get us to do their bidding. It's shameful.
Absolutely. One of the final questions I ask each of my guests is, in your opinion, what does it mean to make the health investment?
Yeah, so I mean, I think of investment generally as being something you put away for future years, right? And we know what it means in terms of retirement savings, right? You save $100 when you're 18 and compound interest. I think that's really true with health too. And my oldest kid is now 24, my youngest is 19, and I'm starting to say to them that sort of, you know, the habits you develop now are going to be really important 50 years down the road. And that's another sort of thing that the food industry is going for us, because most of us are unable to think about life 50 years from now, especially when we're 20 years old. But if you can just a little bit appreciate the long-term value of investing in your health, it's a beautiful thing, and it does pay off down the road, and you will, you know, be 50 years older eventually someday. And what you, you know, what you've invested in terms of your eating habits as a younger person are usually critical. That's why, I mean, if I was emperor for the day, I would put a garden in every school in the world, not just to kind of help feed the kids, but to get them excited about radishes and strawberries and stuff maybe they're not aware of, as just a beginning of regaining control.
It is pretty incredible when a kid waters and grows a plant and then gets the fruit of that, how much more inclined they are to eat it. Or if they even help, they have those cool kid knives now, if they help chop something, or just the buy-in, the investment on their part is so much greater. Even if they would have hated the thing 3 days ago, it's like, oh, well, now I chopped it. So I love it.
It's a priceless way to go at that.
Absolutely. Are your 19 and 24-year-olds really receptive to your ideas of this investment, or are they still a little iffy?
Well, one thing we did when they were younger and, you know, more vulnerable to juice boxes and, you know, lots of snacks and stuff was my wife and I just kind of figured out we really shouldn't preach to them, but rather have a conversation with them. And I'm usually very careful when I give talks to young kids, because I don't want to like freak them out. And you can become overly obsessed by food, and the whole clean food thing can become this extreme thing. But one of the things I've found is that even with elementary school kids, you can have a conversation with them about food that kind of puts processed food in the context of these big companies trying to tell us what to do, and us having the ability really to decide for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think kids really get that.
That's a good point. Yeah, saying you can't have something to any toddler or 5-year-old or 15-year-old typically backfires.
Well, especially when they run over to their friend's house, yeah. You know, there, right?
Absolutely. I'll show you. Yeah, I'll get it over here if you're not going to give it to me. Absolutely. Where can listeners follow and find you?
I have a little website. It's called mossbooks.us. Some of my social media is on there, and so a bunch of my interviews, like this one, are there, and there's my email is there too, so they can send me a note, and I try to respond to every email.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. This was an enlightening conversation. I know that I have a lot of things to think about for myself, and I'm sure listeners do as well. And we're all just very grateful for your time.
Well, thanks for the work that you do. It's really powerful and terrific.
Well, that's all for today. Thanks again for joining me here on the Health Investment Podcast. I'm so grateful for each and every one of my listeners. On your way out, remember to hit subscribe so that you never miss an episode. See you next week. All content in this podcast was created for general informational purposes only by a non-physician. None of the content should serve as a substitute for professional medical advice, treatment, or diagnosis. Always consult a qualified health provider with any questions regarding a medical condition and before making changes to your diet, lifestyle, and/or exercise programs. Do not disregard any professional medical advice you have received or postpone seeking such advice because of something you heard on this podcast.